There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
It's a Dubai Eye 103.8 special.
Broadcasting live from the 2018 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. For the love of words.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With us now in the guest chair, we have Andrew Morton, one of the world's most successful biographers and an acknowledged authority on British and European royalty. Now, your big session yesterday, Andrew, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thanks for inviting me.
It was called Royal Maverick, so you were looking at Diana and a biography of the Duchess of Windsor titled Wallace in Love.
That's right.
Did you enjoy the discussion, first of all?
Yeah, that was a very fun session because so many people were intrigued and very knowledgeable about the Duchess of Windsor, so you didn't have to explain who on earth she was, and obviously people were invested in Princess Diana.
One thing that came up when I popped into that session was the idea of the Queen as an archetype, and you spoke about a man who broke into the Queen's bedroom, and that your interview with him is something that always springs to mind whenever anybody is talking about the way the Queen came down in the wake of Diana's death to speak to a very angry nation, and how she was able to dispel that anger.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I'm looking at the Queen as an archetype, as a mother, and I'm always reminded of that interview I did with Michael Fagan, who broke into Buckingham Palace because he was wanting to see his mother, and why on earth would he go to Buckingham Palace to see his mother? Well, because he felt that she was, that's what she represented to him. And when we were talking about the death of Diana and the anger that people felt, I was always reminded of that interview because people really wanted to be reassured by their archetypal mother.
What was it about the fact that, why did he want to see his mother? He was going through some sort of breakdown, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was going through a breakdown, but the point is that he actually decided that the Queen was his mother, and what people don't realise is that he broke in twice, by the way. He'd been a couple of times, and he found his way into the Queen's bedroom, and there's all these stories about how he sat on the Queen's bed and chatted to her. He just remembers she shouted at him, get out, and then she ran across the room and scarpered.
My main question for you is actually about your choice of subject matter, the fact that you write biographies. You've got about 24 that you've written. You've written about Tom Cruise, you've written about Princess Diana. When do you decide to write about somebody? What does somebody have to, are there certain boxes that they have to tick for you to be interested in them, to want to write their story?
Yes, indeed. I mean, what you want is a narrative arc. You want someone who's developed as a person over the years. And somebody like, say, Angelina Jolie, she started off as a wild child. She was doing drugs. She was an addict. She was really out of control. And yet now here she is, a goodwill ambassador for the United Nations. So you're intrigued to find what were the springs that drove that personality. With the Duchess of Windsor, my latest book, Wallace in Love, I was just intrigued to separate the mythology from the reality. And also, I found tons of new material, and that's one of the things as a biographer I always enjoy doing. It's the exploration of your own ignorance. You don't know much about the person, so you want to find out. And so I found myself in all kinds of archives all the way around the world.
So is the research more enjoyable for you than the actual writing?
Well, yeah, my favourite two words in the English language are the and end.
I have a couple of questions, Andrew, if I may. I'm intrigued. I admire what you do. I think it's a tough gig. I think you do it really well, and obviously the success is there as a badge of honour for you. I think most people listening probably know the difference between an authorised biography and an unauthorised biography. But the question I want to ask you is, what does writing, by and large, unauthorised biographies give you the latitude to do that an authorised biography would not?
Well, I think the irony is that depending on the person, you are writing the same thing. You're doing exactly the same thing. I did a book on the president of Kenya, President Moi, a few years ago. And He was perfectly happy to answer any question whatsoever and to invite anybody to speak to me about any issue whatsoever. And similarly with a book on Monica Lewinsky, she was happy to deal with any topic because they had the, both of them in their different ways, had the courage to allow somebody to delve into their private lives or their personal lives and to report on it. The most dramatic book I've ever written, the most controversial book I've ever written and will probably ever be written about a member of the royal family was Diana, Her True Story, written with the total and complete cooperation with Diana. So the irony is that independent books are very different, are both different and the same as authorised books.
One thing that I'm not sure if this is 100% true, but you initially, this is the 25th anniversary edition that's come out, and we didn't know until recently that she had your blessing.
Well, that I had her blessing.
That you had her blessing, sorry.
Well, it was after her death in 1997 that I first revealed that she'd, and if she'd have lived, I'd be sitting here telling you, no, she had nothing to do with the book. Her friends and family did. So to that extent, it was once she became a historical figure and she'd gone to that palace in the sky, made the decision to reveal the fact that she was very much behind it.
Can we deal with a hard issue? Because I know you've had your critics and you've had a criticism in the past and there are various ugly words that are used against people that are less gifted than you. What are the responsibilities you have to your subjects? Is it to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Or if they're a living subject, do you have them over your shoulders as a sort of shadow thinking, we need to protect the innocent here?
Well, I think what you try and do is give a sense of the personality and who that person is. And you try and describe the narrative arc of their lives.
But people want to know if they're sleeping with the wrong people, if there are affairs, or if they're if there's financial stuff that's going on that they don't want you to know. When you are aware of secrets, or when you are privy to secrets, how far can you go to the real truth?
These days, it very much depends on what the lawyers say, because the law is very strict in Britain.
Yes.
With regards to censorship, with regards to libel, you've really got to be able to prove. But and also, I'd say, it's also the same in America. You can't just throw anything in willy-nilly. You've got to be able to say, these are the sources and this is what they have to say. Is there, and the test is always, is there any malice involved?
Yes,
and
exactly.
And there is no malice involved because I'm a professional writer. I'm not somebody who's got an axe to grind or an agenda. I'm looking at somebody who has an impact on the world. So let's just take Tom Cruise. A very well-known actor, but also someone who's very well-known for his involvement in
Scientology.
Called Scientology. Now, during the 1990s, he was actively trying to alter the education system in America so that Scientology could have a bigger role to play. Now, it behooved a biographer to look at his relationship to Scientology and how that came about. There was no malice in that, it was just an intriguing operation.
Of course, we are running up to a rather large royal wedding in the United Kingdom at the minute with Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. Rumour has it that you're working on a biography of Meghan Markle at the present. Are you able to confirm or deny?
I'm able to confirm that it's called Meghan, a Hollywood Princess, and it will be out in mid-April in
Fantastic.
Both America. And as of this morning, I just gave the final clearance to some of the final pictures.
So I've been
working away in Dubai as well.
It strikes me as maybe a bit of a difference with working with Meghan is that a lot of her life, she's young enough that a lot of her life has been lived in a time of the internet where a lot of what she's done, having been in the public eye from acting and so on, is in public domain. Does this change the nature of how you approach the research?
Very much so. I mean, she has lived in plain sight. She's described everything about her biracial past. She's talked about her parents' divorces. She's talked about her difficulty in getting a foot up the acting ladder. So in many respects, she's actually described her own life in a very vivid and articulate way. So my job has been really just introducing Meghan to the general public in a more considered manner, and at the same time to try and place her in the context of the modern royal family, because quite frankly her involvement in the family shows how far Britain as a nation has moved in the last 80 years. 80 years ago, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, he abdicated because he wants to marry a twice divorced woman with two husbands living. Now, Meghan Markle, with one divorce to her name, biracial, and an American actress who's appeared in all kinds of scenes where clothing has been a semi-optional extra. In many respects, she shows how things have changed over the years.
Well, you mentioned, Annabella and you were talking about Diana earlier on. Of course, we are looking at a royal family that is markedly different from the royal family that we saw over those appalling days at the end of August in 1997. How would you define how they are outward facing now, given what Princess William and Harry are now doing with public domain?
Well, what I would argue is that the Queen, you can almost see the visible relaxation on her face. She genuinely feels that she's found in William and Harry people, two young men who will keep the monarchy going well into the next century, with children who will then continue it.
While also understanding the history and heritage and the legacy that they have been handed, taking into the 21st century. I think it's very well put, Andrew.
Yeah.
One last question from me, and I'll throw back to Annabelle. Given the high-profile nature of all the subjects you naturally deal with in terms of biography, have you learned any sort of central themes of how these people get to the stations that they have, how they get the public profile they have, and what separates them from mere mortals like us?
Well, I think it's often insecurity, it's often a broken family, it's often that kind of always striving for something else, and because of their family background, but also there's often inner strength and inner ambition that is hardwired, that cannot be picked off the shelf.
You see, that fascinates me, because it's that weird concept of insecurity, but also a need to do it, the sort of dedication to do it, because one often mistakes it that for security and confidence, and there's a lack of confidence that drives them, that becomes a confidence once they've got to where they want to get to. And I've always found that a weird disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the fact that their parents split when they were at a young age. I mean, you know, as anyone who discusses actors will always say, that it's almost a cliche that they come from family backgrounds where they were left to their own devices.
Quite. Had to make their own way. Annabelle?
I found something that you said yesterday in the session very interesting about how Meghan is actually being received with more open arms than Catherine was.
Yes, I had an interesting conversation with several people who used to work at Buckingham Palace, and they indicated that in the days when William was romancing Catherine, there was a little bit of niggle about the fact that Catherine's mother was a working class girl from Southall in London. She'd made her own way, she'd worked as an air stewardess, and they, you know, all these remarks about doors to manual and so on. And William gave that kind of criticism oxygen because they split up for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Now, what is interesting about Harry and Meghan, that Harry has not given a cigarette paper of from the moment he said, she's the one for me, to the present day. And he's been totally supportive of her, not allowed any criticism, and in fact, when there has been criticism, any kind of undertones of racism, he's been out there with a public statement. So he's been totally supportive.
In the session yesterday, you were also talking about another royal maverick, Wallis Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor.
Duchess of Windsor, yeah, Wallis Simpson, absolutely.
I was particularly struck by something that you said. You were talking about how the Duke and Duchess of Windsor were particularly self-serving, and one of the things that really struck me was when she said, apparently, a bit of bombing would do Britain some good. Could you provide some context to that?
Yes. When the Nazis invaded France in May 1940, the Duke and Duchess went down to the south of France and then onwards through Spain and to Portugal. And during that time, they made a number of injudicious remarks about the Nazis, about Britain, about the Duke was very offhand about his brother, George VI. They privately called him that stuttering idiot. But also, Wallace said words to the effect that a little heavy bombing would soon bring Britain to its knees and may do it the world of good. So she had a bitterness and a hostility towards Britain and the royal family, engendered by the fact that she was never given the appellation Her Royal Highness. And when some southern towns were being machine gunned by Nazi fighters, she said, well, I've got no sympathy for them, it's one nation against one woman. And when they went to Nassau in the Bahamas, where he was made Governor General, she said that, well, when the Americans have given them 50 destroyers as part of what's called Lend-Lease, at least they should give me my title back. So it was, everything was always about her and her feelings of hurt and contumely with regards to the royal family and with regards to the British nation.
I was really intrigued, and congratulations on your book 17 Carnations, which dealt with the alleged affair between her and von Ribbentrop, and he gave her 17 carnations over a period of time to recognise the number of nights that he supposedly spent with her. And of course we think we know Wallis Simpson largely often through your books and through things like King's Speech and so on and so forth, and she's reviled still because she's the man that stole our king, the woman that stole our king. Weird, against the backdrop of when so many of the great houses of the United Kingdom relied upon young British men marrying wealthy American heiresses, which allowed for the renovation of everything from Blenheim to Althorpe and all sorts of things. I know we're running short on time, so I'll ask just one very quick question. You never met Wallis, unlike so many of your subjects. If you could have 5 minutes around a table with Wallis Simpson, is there a burning question that you'd love to know the answer to?
Yeah. What do you regret? And I think that she would say she regrets marrying Edward VIII, because she was desperate to be queen.
But they were so, I'm amazed to hear you say, they were so in love. She gave up so much for her. She gave up a lot for him.
She gave up an awful lot because she did not have a choice in the matter. And that is a central issue. She spent, as a character, as I describe in Wallis in Love, as a character, she made her own decisions all the way through life.
Yep.
The one big decision that she had no chance of making at all was when the king decided to abdicate. And she was painted literally into a corner.
Yes.
If she left him, she was going to be the blackest woman in history. If she stayed with him, she was going to be reviled by the royal family. So whatever she chose, if any of your listeners remembers that Italian Job, the film, that final scene with the coach hanging over the cliff edge with the gold at one end and Michael Caine at the other end, it's exactly how Wallis must have felt. She did not have the chance to say, no, hang on. And when he rang her in the south of France when she was staying down there, he said, I've abdicated. Her response was, you goddamn fool.
Yeah.
And that sense of disappointment, that sense of hurt, that sense of betrayal stained their relationship. Yes, he was always besotted with her like a little puppy dog, as he was always besotted with every woman he was associated with. And she always was always like a housekeeper, a mother figure. She was never as invested in the relationship as he was.
I wasn't aware of that. If you could ask a question of him, what would that be?
Oh, do you regret
abdicating?
Abdicating, yeah.
To be with the woman you love.
Yeah, so you say.
Ooh.
We've got time for about one final question, and something that I think the audience asked you, which I thought was very interesting, because we just had International Women's Day on Thursday the 8th, and it was about how far you think that these two characters were feminists.
Yes, I mean, certainly Wallis was not a feminist by any stretch of the imagination. She was groomed for marriage. She was anxious to get married. She was competitive. She was the first one in her class to get engaged. She went around Baltimore showing off her engagement ring. She always said that her job, role in life, was to comfort and entertain and nurture a man in their lives, in their roles. And she never saw any kind of role for herself as in work or in anything that we would see today as being part of an executive position.
And Diana?
Diana, I think, very much was the a feminine woman who became a feminist, in the sense that you could see her growth over the years from being a shy, blushing bride to being the independent humanitarian that she became towards the end of her life, when she was on her own, when she was single, when she was making her own decisions without anybody from the royal family or the royal household telling her what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Just before we chucked away, can I say thank you?
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.